Thanks very much. Make yourself as comfortable as you can. That's not a simple thing to do, is it? There really is a lot of room down here, and I don't spray too much, even for an old man. So it's relatively safe. I'm Tom Ivester, an alcoholic, and a member of the primary purpose group of AA in Southern Pines, North Carolina. My sobriety date is February 2nd, 1957. And I have never heard those 12 traditions before in my life. Wonderful. Well, it truly is great to be here. I've enjoyed what little bit I've had a chance to see here at Tahoe's, and I've enjoyed the fellowship a great deal, as much as I could. And I thought he was trying to kill me, too. When I first came in, I was sick as a mule, and I'm normally a high tenor. And now I sound like anything but. But I'm coming out of the woods, I think, and I'm going to try to get through this without coughing, sneezing, wheezing, or dripping, if I can do it. I am delighted to be here. The one thing about getting old is that everything brings back memories. Everything reminds you of something. A lot of times it reminds you of stuff that didn't even happen. But this, it struck me, if you haven't seen it, take a peek at if you hadn't caught on to what that is. The logo on this conference is Dr. Bob's Kitchen, the place where Alcoholics Anonymous really came into being. And that brought back a very special memory. I've got tons of highlights in my life in Alcoholics Anonymous, but certainly that kitchen was one of them. And in 85, I was asked to be one of the speakers at the 50th anniversary of Alcoholics Anonymous. And my instinctive reaction was to think of the checkered career and to lapse back into that sort of insecure thing. And my first thought was, why on earth would they ask a guy like me? My God, we've got learned people, famous people, articulate people, excellent speakers all over the world of every stripe. Why on earth would they get a guy like me? And then I thought about the peculiar makeup of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought, my God, why not a guy like me? Because that's what we're about. We're not about the proud or well-stationed. We're about folks who've taken the beating and have been graced with recovery. And so it doesn't make too much difference what our lineage is. That's what's important to us. The other thing that grew out of that experience, after I spoke up there that day, we went over to the house, to Dr. Bob's house in Ardmore, and just casually going through, and somebody said, Tom, would you like a sandwich? And I said, sure, why not? So we sat down at what looks very much like that kitchen table. Now, I had read AA Comes of Age. I had visualized. You know how you visualize things when you read the story? I had visualized that place and what the coffee must have been like in that first coffee pot that sits there today. And so what I was doing was walking through something I dreamed about. And so when I went in to have the sandwich, I sat down at that table with Dr. Bob's son and his daughter and my host. Now, I never said a word to anybody, but that was a true mountaintop experience, to be able to be at the place where it all began and to sit with the folks who are now Bob, little Bob, young Bob, whatever you call him, is now the only living witness to what happened. I was with him 2 weeks ago out in Seattle, and we talked about the fact that he's the only person left who actually experienced what went on. So that did. Now, those things did happen. That was not imagination. But that brings back very, very rich memories. If you haven't had the pleasure of visiting Dr. Bob's house, by all means do it. It's a tremendous trip. Well, I'm supposed to talk a lot about drinking and puking and stuff. And, all the thrilling days of yesteryear. I'm a great aficionado of drunkalogs. Some people don't like them. My God, I love them. I love anybody's drunkalog. I even love it when they're still in it. There's just something interesting about drunks. I don't feel too bad about that either, because that book that we read out of, about one-fourth of that is about the nitty-gritty of alcoholism. So I don't minimize the value of drunk logs, mine or anybody else's. I don't think I'm going to have to encourage y'all. I've noticed y'all speak up pretty readily. If I start getting too low, it's aggravating not to hear, even if it doesn't make sense. And probably won't seem like it to you, but I'm going to be talking as fast as I can. Still sounds like slow motion, the best I can do. And people down south talk slow, walk slow, think slow. I'm talking a lot faster than I think most of the time. So I'm going to talk as fast as I can. So y'all let me know if it starts to get a little lean, and we'll rev it up or kiss the... We can't get much closer. But I'm going to punish myself tonight and not just drunk a log it to death. Now, I'm going to talk a little bit about liquor, because that does have a very clear relationship to what we're doing here tonight. I don't want to ever drift off into philosophy 102 and forget what the nitty-gritty is here. But I'm going to talk a little bit. I've got freedom on my mind, and I don't know why, but I do. I've got freedom on my mind. And so I want to kind of build it around the notion of the freedom that comes. I think maybe some of the folks that spoke earlier have triggered those thoughts. Maybe they had to do it. And, you know, when I think about how a guy like me wound up in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, the only thing I know is that, you know, if I think back right now, 41 years ago, I was a young guy, 24 years old, which makes me 58. Give or take. I was sitting in a maximum custody penitentiary with absolutely no real hope of ever walking out of there. No real hope. Looking back on a legacy that was filled with nothing but shame and embarrassment and humiliation and damage and injury and death, a legacy that clearly, vividly said that life never should have happened. And now 41 years later, that same guy is in Taos, New Mexico, with a bunch of old friends and an even bigger bunch of brand new friends. And we're celebrating the gift of life in Alcoholics Anonymous. And now I look back on a legacy that for the past 41 years has been filled with nothing but the development of warm and wonderful relationships all over this world. Meaningful relationships. People that I care about very deeply. It's a real, real rewarding thing to me. The day I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I was the most isolated guy I've ever met. Bar none. And I work with a whole ton of folks. And today I don't know of a state in North America or Canada that I could go to a meeting and the likelihood would be great that I would run into somebody I know. What a tremendous, tremendous gift. And so that's what we celebrate here tonight. Now I want to talk about those two guys. Now I want to talk about that young guy that wound up in physical bondage and lived in greater bondage, which makes the second Tom Ivester even more difficult to believe. Now, I'm not a causation freak. I'm not somebody who searches out the etiology of alcoholism. I have a passing interest in it, and I've read a little. I mean, I don't want to be totally stupid about the thing that'll kill me if I get tangled up with it again. So I've got a little bit of insight, but the insight that's valuable to me is what I've learned in my book and what I've learned from my fellows in the program. Our book refers to alcoholism. It describes it a lot of ways. One of the ways that it describes it says that its roots are in self-centered isolation. And when I look at the constellation of problems that were my life, most all of those were rooted in self-centered isolation. So what's that about? Yeah, when I look at where this guy came from, it's really interesting to me that, you know, my sister and I only have one sibling. I don't know who invented that word, sibling. But someone ought to be in a brood of chickens or something. Anyway, my sister used to be older sister. She used to be 7 years older than me. And by some strange alchemy, we're now twins. We're the same age. I think the girl took up lying. We lived in the same state, same town, same house, same parents, same food, same climate, same schools, same churches. You know, obviously, well, not obviously, but it happened that we did grow up in exactly the same environment with totally different results. She still lives in the same town that I despised even before I knew there were other towns. She stayed there. She adapted. I reacted. She did a lot better than me. Yeah, that girl's never been in jail in her life, except to get me out. So she did a lot better than me. But I was somebody who just was geared such a way that I couldn't stand that. I couldn't take the discipline that would have required to function in that environment. I just despised that place. I disliked everything about it. I want to identify just one thing of many, but just one thing that sort of shaped the guy that led to the bondage. My dad, you know, I didn't realize how important a dad is in the life of a child until I had children of my own. And started to see how important a father can be. Now, one reason I never knew that is because I never had one that it had any effective role in my life. My father left the family when I was 4 years old. I remember the day it happened. Well, not clearly, but I remember seeing him walk down the road and knowing that he wouldn't be back. I remember the kind of puzzled mind. Not much, but I remember that. Yeah, that's not an insignificant event in the life of a child when a parent walks away. And you simply don't do that to a four-year-old child without injury. Now, my sister reacted differently than me to that. But I reacted in it in a way that really had impact. In such a way that I became a guy who tended to be isolated. Who tended to be locked up in himself. Who tended to be very reluctant to invest trust in people. I wouldn't let anybody get close to me. It took me a long time, sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, before I could comfortably let anybody do something for me. And like Glenda said Friday night, it not only diminishes or gives them control, it also lets them into my life. And so I started to grow up as a sort of self-centered, isolated kid. People don't disappoint you if you don't let them get to you. And so I grew up with several other things, but that was the way I responded to life. That's the way I reacted. And I developed ways of protecting myself with what I saw, I guess, as the adversities of life. Well, that led into something that we call defects of character. We call defects of character. Where I learned to have certain ways of coping that helped me get through life. Yeah, I learned how to be delusional, so I didn't have to look clearly at things. I learned how to isolate. I learned fear. I learned to lie. Yeah, I am an inveterate liar. I try not to lie now, but I'm still by nature a liar. Only way I tell the truth is practice. Yeah, if you came into my home at 3 o'clock in the morning and woke me up real quick and said, "What are you doing here?" I'd make up a story. I mean, that's my instinct. I don't blurt out the truth. I blurt out a lie. But because those things go deep and they come back quickly. And so that was what happened. You know, when I first got in the program, y'all hear okay? Am I too loud? Okay. May not make it. Got to get some more Alka-Seltzer. When I first came into the program, heard people talking about defects of character, I thought they were talking about naughty things I did. I didn't understand we're talking about flaws in my makeup, defects in my character, so that I had unhealthy, unfunctional ways of coping in life. Now, I survived very, very well with them. It's all I had. And boy, how deep-seated those things became, those defects of character. So I grew up with that sort of a tangle of emotions as a young guy. And then when I found my first drink, I found the thing my buddy John was talking about today. Not a problem, I found a solution. Because my first meaningful drink was a magical solution for the many problems of my life. And I just fell in love with that stuff. I wasn't an alcoholic. I was a miserable young guy who found a magical solution to the problems of life. I would have been stupid not to drink. And I wasn't stupid. Man, I just took off like a runaway train. I loved everything about booze. I loved the bottle they put it in. I loved the places they sold it. I loved those trashy people that hung around those places. I loved that stuff that went on between the actors. I loved waking up in strange places with strange people. Up to a point. I woke up one time married, and I didn't like that too much. She didn't either. Apparently, she divorced me 3 months later. But I like most of that. I like the sense of anxiety or anticipation that something's getting ready to jump off. If it ain't here, it's going to be the next place. And if it don't happen pretty soon, I'm going to start something. Just get something going. Well, I love that. I love those old raunchy places down south. I lived a lot of my time up in Michigan. I love those cool, dark jazz joints. Good God, man, I could listen to the train and blow smoke and suck on some call. Well, God. I mean, I just loved it. I loved that scene. And I'll tell you, I'm not here as a representative of the WCTU. I ain't mad at drinking. I mean, I'm all for drinking. That's where our members come from. So I always like to encourage folk to drink. Don't want to run out of new meat. So I'm not here on moral grounds. I guarantee you, if I could have continued, that looked bad to an observer, I'm sure. But it didn't look bad to me. Man, that felt great from the inside. And if I could have stayed even at that level of disrepute, I'd be doing that tonight. I guarantee you that's what I'd be doing. I'm not here on moral grounds. I'm here because I developed alcoholism. I don't know why. There's a lot of theories about it I won't even go into because they don't make any difference. They're interesting but not highly important. What is important for me to know is that at some point something happened to me, and we sometimes refer to it as crossing a line. Mine was uncontrolled drinking then, really, but cross the line, it was controlled to a point, not very well. But then I crossed the line, and it became uncontrolled drinking. Now, I didn't know that. I had not an inkling of that till I was sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I found it difficult to believe even after I got here. But I never understood what was happening. But once I crossed that line, the thing that became apparent to me when I look back at it was that once I took a drink, unlike the wild parties that might linger, I no longer could predict what I would do if I drank. And I set up the weirdest pattern of behavior you've ever seen in doing bizarre stuff. I have awakened in the middle of a U.S. highway taking a nap. Draped over railroad tracks with an engine coming, trying to fight guys who are getting me off the tracks. Married is about as bad as either of those. In jail, God knows how many times, because I don't. I like to think the exact right number of times, because I haven't been to jail since I got sober, except to visit. I like to think it was exactly the right number. Maybe one less would have been too few. One more might have been too many. I like to think it was the right number. Well, those things started to happen. Let me tell you, I just want to sum it up this way. I'm going to make it sound like it'd be 30 seconds. It'd be a little longer than that. But I want to kind of get at it this way. Even though those were a wide array of bizarre behaviors, they had a disgusting similarity when I look back at it. the events and circumstances and how well-financed they were and who I drank with, those things changed. But what didn't change once I developed alcoholism was a sickening similarity in terms of what happened. I would almost invariably find myself in one of those bizarre deals. And I was a guy who had blackouts a lot. And when you're a guy as reckless as me, you do wake up in strange places. And I woke up in so many strange places, I developed an instinct, very good skill, of waking up mentally and showing no movement. You know, I would come awake and not open my eyes. Because all too often you'll find some idiot standing there asking you really troubling questions like, who are you? And or what are you doing here? And you hate to say, where? And so I developed a capacity to just wake up mentally and listen for the sounds of evidence. And if I heard clanging, I knew it was okay because I was in jail where I was supposed to be. And otherwise, well, one night I woke up, and I'm not going to get into war stories, but just one, I can't pass up. One morning I came to in a house, and I heard a very, very angry woman in the kitchen wanting to know from somebody who that drunken SOB was in her daughter's bed. And I just had a clear impression with my keen alcoholic mind that she was talking about me. That's the stillest I've ever laid in my life because I didn't want that old turkey landing on me. And so I laid there for the longest kind of time. And then when I finally got a chance to get out the door, I was next door. I only missed my house by one. God. I know guys personally who are doing life in prison for that. It's Jesus. Well, I mean, it was a minor deal, you know. Unless you got caught doing something like that. Well, that kind of stuff just happened over and over. What was disgustingly similar was that every time I would wake up in one of those things, look around, see what had happened, put it together, and then it would be basically the same drill. Well, you've done it again. You're no good. You're worthless. You have no responsibility. You have no discipline. And that would usually lead into all of the rest of the moral beatings, everything from suicide to just disappearing, and then finally, usually, going back. What was very, very important to me about that, and I never knew this till I was sober in AA, was that I never personally saw that behavior clearly until I was sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. Yeah, I had some vague thing of what happened, but I never had any clear realization of what was going on until I was sober in AA and looked back at it. You know, it's led me to believe something. You know, denial is a very voguish term right now. Yeah, everybody uses it for every condition. One place you won't find it is in our book. Well, obviously the word existed when our book was written. I really think it was selective avoidance by not using denial because I don't think it addresses the problem. It's too lightweight. What our book talks about is delusion, an inability to see ourselves as we are, an inability to differentiate the true from the false. And that was exactly what was going on with dancing that tragic dance over and over and over again with the same results and never seeing what was going on. The other thing that was going on in that period was that I was just crashing downhill. My serious drinking only lasted a period of 8 years. I would not have been a 30-year drinker. A guy that drinks like me doesn't drink 30 years, I guarantee you. You know, it looks to me like alcoholics these days come in two basic varieties. One is the kind who drinks with relative control for a long period of time and then just goes off to end and doesn't come back. That's a real alcoholic, no question about that. But there is an increasingly large number of folk, I think I was one of the pioneers of this type, that are basket cases from day one. I mean, man, they're screwball day one and don't get no better. And I was one of those. But mine lasted 8 years. And all I have to do to understand the impact of alcoholism for this guy is remember the fairly bright young fellow bounced out of high school, 16 years old, set out to conquer the world. 8 years later, I'm living on the streets in the city of Flint, Michigan, in a city of 500,000, unemployed and darn near unemployable. Now, obviously, I didn't just fall off the high school stage to Skid Row. You know, I worked my way there one drink at a time, but they were very close together. And so I had a fairly concentrated journey. But yeah, I read something somewhere. It doesn't really apply to me, but it sets the principle that the chains of habit go on so gently that you don't feel them till they're too strong to break. Now, certainly mine was not a gentle habit occurring, but it was such a subtle process that I was past the point of no return before I even realized I was in trouble. I just never stopped to examine what was going on. I was too busy doing it. And so 8 years later, I wind up in that city. I went to work when I first got up there, and then my reputation got in front of me, and I couldn't get a job. I'd get one once in a while, come out, hole up in some room and house for a couple, 3 weeks or whatever, and then ride back again. And I pray God that I never forget the last year of my drinking. I pray God that I never forget. Not what happened physically, but what happened on the inside. What happened to this young guy. You know, it's really telling to me that when I first came in the program, yeah, I used to think guys that had not roughed it like I had really got in cheap. You know, the folks who came in here with their resources intact and with cars and jobs and money got in cheap. They were sort of second-class members.
Emergency phone call for B.B. Myers. Sorry.
Is that B.B.? Until I started to understand that the real problem with alcoholism is what happens on the inside, not on the outside. You see, I'm an alcoholic. I've told you just a few little crazy things, but my alcoholism isn't defined by how many times I went to jail. Most alcoholics have never gone to jail. Most alcoholics in AA have never gone to jail, not once. That's a commentary on the quality of law enforcement now, not our behavior. I never met anybody who didn't deserve to go a time or two. But the majority of alcoholics never have gone to jail. It's not defined by that. It's not defined by sleeping in the U.S. highway. I know very few alcoholics who've done that and lived to tell about it. It's not defined by that. It's not defined by how many times I had my nose broke, by how much I drank, how long I drank, how what my DTs were like. It's not defined by that. It's defined by one simple thing. My favorite line in the book, I don't know the page number, but I could make one up, but it'd be wrong. It's in the chapter about alcoholism. It's my favorite line in the book, and probably one of the most innocuous statements at first reading in the whole deal, where it simply says this. We alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking. Thank God for that. To my way of thinking, that's the only clear, specific definition of alcoholism in our book, because it tells me exactly what it is, that it isn't determined by quantity or longevity or severity or that kind of junk. It's when a human being loses the ability to control. And every problem I have cited to you was the result of my inability to control my drinking. I've never been to jail sober. I'm not a criminal. I'm an alcoholic who just screwed up a lot of stuff. Like you say about a cockroach. You don't get mad at a cockroach because of what he eats or carries off. You get mad at him for what he falls in, messes up. Well, that's the way I was. I was kind of a cockroach drunk. You know, I didn't carry off much or eat much. I just messed up a lot of stuff. It's very tough to run a good place of business, some drunk throwing up on your carpet. That's very difficult. But that's what happened to me. I lost the ability to control my drinking, and in a rush and hurry, I wound up living in conditions I would have never imagined. I pray to my God that I never forget one second the nature of that. I never want to forget for one second what it was like to wander the face of this earth with no place I could comfortably call home. I pray God I never forget it. I don't want to forget what it was like to play the idiot in a bar so somebody would buy me a drink. Or to roll other drunks, rob folks, take from them. Yeah, I don't search out amends there. It's that's just one of the things. You know, I mean, that was the way that world operated. One day I was a little friskier, and the next day the other guy was. That was just the way it worked. I don't want to forget doing that. I don't want to forget selling my blood $5 a throw, lining up somewhere for a handout. Given people, but I remember the demeaning feeling. And I pray to my God that I never know that again. That omnipresent sense of fear of everything and of nothing. A nagging fear that was my companion every waking hour and most of the nights. The peculiar loneliness of alcoholism that has little to do with the proximity of other people. I have been exquisitely lonely in the circle of my own family, in the arms of a loving woman, in the midst of a raucous party. The loneliness of alcoholism. Well, it would be nice, a good many of you are not aware, but a lot of you are aware, that it'd be nice if I could tell you that somebody threw me a rope and I grabbed it, but it didn't work that way. I think I could have responded any number of times. Because God knows how many times I hit bottom. You know, bottom isn't one fixed place. I hit many times. But I think for something to happen, you have to hit bottom and find a solution relatively close together, or it doesn't happen. And so that's who I was. And unfortunately, it just didn't happen. And I woke up one morning in jail there in Flint. No novelty to that. That was routine. And after I was awake a little while, the jailer walked by, asked him when I could get out, and he said, "I hope never." And walked off, and I had no idea what he was talking about, not a clue. And then some of the other guys in there told me the night before, I'd been driving somebody's car down the main street of the city, and it ran over and killed two people. And absolutely no recollection then, now, or ever, but no question whatsoever that that's what I did. And so my reaction, even though I was a real strange character, I was not a subhuman, I was not an insensitive guy, and my response was, I just could not deal with that. I couldn't accept it. I could believe it, but I just couldn't accept it. And then gradually accept the truth. The only time I'd ever been in jail, didn't try to get out. And then somebody that worked at that jail learned that I had family in North Carolina and contacted them. And my mother and sister made what was to be, certainly to be my mother's last trip to anybody's jail to get her little boy. It wasn't her first one, but it was to be her last one. But she died some 29 years later with a heart full of gratitude for a program that had given her a son, of whom she was extremely proud. And I'll tell you, of all the stuff I've ever done in Alcoholics Anonymous 10 times over, it would be worth it for what I just said. Powerful thing. Well, I didn't know how to tell them I didn't want to get out of jail. I was afraid to get out. I knew I wouldn't drink. I mean, you know, if it's bad enough, you'll quit, won't you? Don't believe that. Not if you're talking about alcoholism. I got out and walked the streets for a day and a half, and of course I drank. From July to November of 56, I drank, honestly, like nobody I've ever seen. I have worked with thousands of alcoholics.
And I was the guy who just gave in to the condition. A wino could have diagnosed me. And I was clearly trying to drink myself to death. You know, a lot of people say they didn't commit suicide because they didn't have nerve or something. That was not even a consideration. The only thing that kept me from doing myself in was adding further question and shame to a family that had already had too much. And I always figured if I just got drunk and didn't wake up, that would be a nice way out. That would at least leave a question. Well, the 19th of November of 56 was actually the date of my last drink. My sobriety started the following February when I went into AA, but the 19th of November was the last drink, and to this date, I hope it's the last one forever. And that day I went to court. There was no trial in the sense of prosecution defense. They had no defense. I mean, what do you say? Somebody going to try you over something that happens in a total blackout? What do you say? I didn't even know there was such a thing, but I entered a plea to stand mute. What a great statement for a guy with that kind of deal. I was, of course, found guilty, sentenced to a max of 15 years in Michigan State Penitentiary, and I was not surprised. I knew that was going to happen. Something was going to happen. And I remember that day as clearly as if it were today. I remember the very normal reaction of fear, because even though I'd been in jail everywhere I'd ever been, I knew where I was going was not an overnight drunk tank. I knew that. I was going to Jackson Prison, and it's my honest evaluation would be that it's probably the second or third worst penitentiary in the United States. The day I walked in there, 6,000 guys wandering around that place. And some of them were very fine people, some of the finest people I ever met in my life, and some of the scurviest jokers that ever drew breath. And I knew that I wouldn't live to get out of there. I knew that. Because I was a young guy. You know, they didn't normally keep a guy as young as me in a max joint in Michigan, but my record was just so unbelievable that they knew if I saw daylight, I'd be gone. And so I stayed in maximum custody the whole time I was there. And so when they passed that sentence and I walked into that joint, I honestly did believe it was over for me, that I was done, and didn't care. I really didn't care. And it was not callous disregard. I just didn't care. All I wanted to do was disappear. I just wanted to be gone. Never spoke to anybody. I engaged in no conversation with anybody unless they asked me a direct question. Then I would grudgingly answer and spend the rest of my time sitting in the cell, reading anything just to keep from thinking. Little did I know that was to be the place of a brand new start. A guy called me out one day, interviewed me. A lot of people had done that, recognized my alcoholism. A lot of people had done that. Then he did something nobody else had ever done. Alcoholics Anonymous had come into being a few years before I got there. And he said there was a group there at that institution, and he thought it'd be good for me to go. It wasn't an order. I didn't have to go, and it was certainly not an invitation. It was just a flat observation that you have a group, think you better go. And I walked into my first meeting, Groundhog Day of 57, just like you were at your first one, I'm sure, but not an inkling of what this would be. And sat down in the middle of 300 folk. One guy spoke to me. Thank God nobody hugged me. I like it hugging now, but we didn't do any hugging. I'll just put it that way. And I sat and listened. They read the stuff, and then they introduced a speaker, a guy named Shy Walker from Kalamazoo, Michigan, and what a marvelous fellow. He was the Michigan State delegate to the General Service Conference the year I heard him. And I wouldn't have known what that meant if he'd have said it in Farsi or any more than I would if he said it in English. But he told his story, and I swear to God, I'd never heard a story like that. I've heard drunks tell stories, but not that guy was obviously telling his own. And when he got through, I had absolutely no sense of identification. I tell you, in case you find it difficult to tie in here, I was in this program almost 2 years before I ever heard one single speaker with whom I identified. Now I hardly ever hear anybody that I don't identify with. I guess the breed is getting better now or something. And I sat there at a meeting, and the only remarkable thing is that I was back the next week. I didn't join up. I just came back. And I think the one thing that brought me back and I try to practice it to this day, was not the words of that guy, the message of that guy in words. It was the spirit of the guy. The spirit of the guy. Because Shai was one of the most remarkably enthusiastic people I had ever met in my life. After I got to know him a bit, I asked him, I said, man, don't you have bad days? And he said, sure. God, I'm human. Everybody has bad days. And I said, well, how come you're always upbeat? And he said, I'll tell you, Tom. He said, every time I go in, he'd been sober 15 years then. And he said, every time I go into a meeting, I always do a little exercise with myself. I remind myself of who I am and where I'm going. I remind myself that I'm 15 years sober. And I remind myself that I have a self-appointed obligation to act like it. And so when I go in that, I try to go in there looking like a guy with 15 years so I can be a decent example to somebody else. The power of enthusiasm is a contagious quality. If you don't believe it, I'll give you a little field trip you can try. Pick out the raunchiest group you know. One that you think ought to have its franchise lifted. One where they don't even greet each other. And go over there one night on a mission. Make yourself the welcoming committee. Welcome them to their own group. And you'll be amazed before you're halfway through. It's amazing how one enthusiastic person can generate power in a room. I know people, John, you do, I know, because you're one of them, my sweetheart. There are people who can walk into a room and light it up simply by walking in. Powerful, powerful thing. That's what brought me to Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't understand any of the words. And so I just dug in and started going. My first 8 months in the program were as miserable as any period I've ever endured in my life. I didn't fall in love with it. It didn't seem like a good cause I'd want to join. These people were not talking about not drinking forever. My God, I never even thought in terms like that, much less commitments. I sat there for a good while thinking, my God, what if this thing kicks in on me? And I'm going to get struck dry in here and never get to have no more fun. I tell you, if you knew, you got to be careful how long you hang around. Because they'll get you. They'll get you. I stayed there too long, and I swear to God, I never meant to stay sober this long. I never meant to get this good. I tell you that. I didn't have this in mind at all. And I don't do nothing. I feel like a monk. Wife of my dashing young man like me coming to Taos, New Mexico, unattended. And she didn't even tell me to behave. That old turkey, I'm going to show her one of these days. No, I'm not either. No, she doesn't tell her that because she knows she doesn't need to. But that was a miserable time, that first 8 months, because I didn't feel at home here. I didn't identify. I said I was an alcoholic because I hated to be the only one out of 300 that wasn't. So they all said they were. I said, yeah, me too. But it didn't mean a thing. It was just a word. But I was fortunate in that the recovery group at that penitentiary was an excellent group. I am heartbroken to tell you that it was probably superior to 90% of the groups that I visit in this country today. In the sense of being strong and purposeful and committed to introducing people to a new way of life. I'll always be grateful for that solid foundation that was set for me by guys in that joint. Now, I'm not talking about experts imported from somewhere else. I'm talking about guys in the joint just like me. Only difference was they were a little in front. Fine, fine, fundamental grounding. The people who walked in like Shy from the outside stuck out an unquestioning hand of fellowship to a guy like me. God, what that meant. So slowly something was happening. I've always been a reader, and I read everything I could find. It had an A on it, but it was rather defensive reading. I was trying to find something that said everybody's an alcoholic like this except him. I wanted to be him. And then one day, I tell you what turned the corner for me. I went to a meeting, fat, dumb, and innocent. And the guy who spoke But he was a good friend, later to become a good friend until he died, that from Flint, that he spent the entire meeting talking about nothing but the fourth step. That's all. Wasn't a lecture. He just shared about that fourth step, stressed the importance of writing the thing. And when he got through, now I'd done a little reading about it. I knew what he was talking about intellectually. But this isn't a thinking program, is it? It's a living program. I never seen anybody. I know some brilliant big book technicians who can't stay sober 30 minutes. Got to get it into life, you know. And so I knew the words, but I didn't know the inventory. And so I went over and listened to him, went back to my cell afterward, and I said, okay, I'm going to do that. And what I meant to do was write a little story about the tragedies of my life and be quick to show it to somebody. The founders were wise when they said to write. Because I tell you, if you can write yourself a fairy tale like that, you really got some problems. I wrote about two lines of what I had in mind. And there was no intent whatsoever. I've had a lot of people tell me it's tough to take a fourth step. Maybe it is. It took me about 9 months and 30 minutes. 9 months of anguish, 30 minutes of execution. Because I wrote those two lines, and then with absolutely no plan, it was as if the dam broke. And I had what old Hemingway referred to as that moment of truth. The point where a person comes face to face with themselves. And that's exactly what happened. All at once, the charade was over. And it was a literal torrent, a flood of things that just came up that I had never even thought about in my life. My hand raced trying to keep up with the torrent of thoughts. And when I got through, I had three pages of scribble on that old legal pad, barely legible. Wasn't fit for print, wasn't written for print. I tell you what it was the most important day of work this old boy has ever done in his entire life, bar none. Because that day, a foundation in Alcoholics Anonymous was formed. That day, I knew without any question that I was alcoholic. I'd had a heck of a battle with booze, but I lost. And the evidence of my life clearly communicated to me that I was somebody who just couldn't drink. I didn't have an option to drink any longer. I may have an option for alcoholic insanity, but I have no option to drink. And I knew that day that I was alcoholic, period. Not the young guy, the complicated case, the tragic guy, the smart kid, none of that. I was an alcoholic. I have never doubted that one second to this day. Come close to drinking a few times, but I have never once doubted nor had that old delusional system kick in. Well, maybe you overreacted and got here too quick. That just hasn't happened. The other thing that happened that day, I became a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, a functioning, recovering member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I've never wavered in either of those. Now, I don't like to overly aggrandize any step, but that was what really solidified. The other things were just foggy notions. And that's what solidified and made real what this process was about. Then I moved into some action. I want to wrap this up because it's too hot to talk long. I don't mind. My voice is holding out. What the hell time is it? I didn't set my watch. What time is it? What time we start? At 8? 7:30. Oh, okay. God knows. I thought I hadn't been talking 30 minutes, and I knew I ain't never been this tired in 30 minutes. That's what happened. And let me just sort of tell you in a real sum up kind of a way. I want to head for the home stretch and not overpromise, but I won't be over 10 minutes. I promise you that, because it's just too hot. I want to use a couple of terms. I want to define them first. I want to use the term miracle. And I'm not talking about some mystical occurrence. I'm a practitioner of the spiritual life the way it's spelled out in the book. I'm a deeply spiritual person. I think it's great to have my head in the clouds, but just like the book says, good to keep my feet on the ground. And so I'm somebody who likes to have spiritual life as a part of life. It needs to be very, very vibrant in my work life, my driving life on the freeway, my home life, my community life. It needs to be all of those places, otherwise it's a myth. And so that's the way I like to approach it. And when I look at miracles, I don't like to take the wonder out of miracles, but I like to have them have meaning in my life. And what I've come to believe miracles are, is that when I give my life to this simple program, miracles occur when preparation and opportunity come together. Remember what I was saying a while ago about hitting bottom? That's preparation. But it doesn't mean a thing if a solution is unknown. If a solution comes along and you haven't hit bottom, there won't be any sobriety, will there? It's what happens when preparation and opportunity come together. A farmer plows a field, plants a bean, God causes beans to grow. The miracle of that. Man and woman come together, a seed is planted, and God causes birth to occur. Now, I'm a deeply spiritual person, but I'm a fairly pragmatic guy. I like to have real life terms on these and then to have meaning. So I want to use the term a little bit because I had some miraculous things happen. I didn't campaign for anything. I had 15 years. Even after I got an A, I didn't really believe I'd ever live to get out of that place. I knew I would die with dignity, though. I knew that. And some things started to happen. I didn't even know they were miraculous at the time. I was recommended for special parole. I didn't make it. But I didn't realize that only happens once out of 10,000 cases. And all I was doing was drinking and not drinking and going to meetings and having a change of life. You know, miracles happen. I did finally get out. Doesn't take a genius to get out of jail, just takes time. And I had a ton of miraculous things happen. Let me tell you the other thing that I wanted to define that kind of makes this easier to talk about. You wonder about how a guy can get from that point to looking back on the legacy that I described in the past 41 years. Yeah? I mean, how does that happen? Am I just somebody lucky? Am I just politically wired or knew Bill Wilson or something? You know, what is it that causes a guy to have... You could not believe the life I've had for the past 41 years. And what is it that makes that happen? Well, I'll tell you what I believe. I'll tell you a discouraging thing first. So far, in Alcoholics Anonymous, I have never consciously solved a significant problem in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Not one time have I sat in a meeting and said, by golly, that's it. Now I got it. No. You heard the term, we use the term, sobriety is not a destination, it's a journey. There's a place, and I hope you're familiar with it. If not, I hope you'll take a look at it. There's a place that distills what happens in that statement superbly for me. And I just sort of found it by accident one day. It's in the preface of the 12 and 12, of all places. And where it's just got a blurb by saying what the steps are. What it says, basically, I'll screw it up, but I'll be close enough that you can find it. What it says is that our steps are a set of principles, spiritual in their nature. Now, here's where it gets good. Which, if practiced as a way of life, not studied or worked or seminared or written or talked about, what? If practiced as a way of life, will do two things that are unbelievable for a guy like me. That if I practice these as a way of life, it will, number one, expel the obsession to drink. Interesting word. Did that to me in the fifth grade of school. Expelled. But it has more meaning than that. I looked it up. And what expel means is to press out, to force out. A lot different than finding something, isn't it? And what happens in this thing, set of principles, if practice a way of life, will expel the obsession to drink. And then the second thing, will enable the sufferer to become usefully whole. Now, I'm here to tell you that's not poetry. That's an absolute fact. You know that old scale of justice that you see with the blindfolded lady, you know, with the scales? When, picture this for how I came in. Think about how you came in. My life was loaded with defects of character. That's all it was. Every emotion, feeling, and idea that I had was negative. It was negative. I didn't like anything. I didn't like birds. I mean, I didn't like nothing. I was a mad, angry, fearful, isolated guy. And I was loaded down with defects of character. I've never solved a one of them that I know about. I've never learned how not to hate. Never learned that. Or how not to fear. Rather, what happens is as these principles are practiced as a way of life, lo and behold, I start to learn to love a little bit. Instead of being afraid, I learn to have faith and have belief and confidence. And lo and behold, the scales even out sometimes. And sometimes, particularly after a deal like we're doing here, sometimes, man, they go overboard. I'll leave one of these things sometime or my home group, and I'm so happy I'm left-handed. I'm dangerous on the highway because I grin at people and wave at them. They think you're nuts. Yeah. But that's what happens. The overtime. I've never solved a single problem. But lo and behold, I'm going this road of happy destiny, and I take a look around, and I ain't mad at nobody. I don't know where it went. The obsession is gone. I haven't had an obsession to drink for 36 years. But I would not be surprised if I had one in Taos, New Mexico tonight. Nor would I be unprepared. I'm an alcoholic. I didn't used to be. I have alcoholism. All that I have is a 41-year overlay of practicing these principles. The obsession has been expelled, but it ain't far away. Old John's sitting on it for me right there. And all I got to do to visit that sucker is let up on these practice of these principles, and look who's knocking at my door. Well, that's what happened. That started for me then. And sometimes that works so well that I get in a zone sometimes, and you probably do too. You ever heard of Michael Jordan? You ever heard? He's a little skinny guy from down in North Carolina. Plays basketball or something. He's building a home about 5 miles from me right now. Some of that money going to just fly right over there. We'll ignore him and let him have obscurity. I don't know if you remember this or not, but they were in a Knicks game, playing the Knicks. And Michael had one of those days when he couldn't miss. I mean, man, he could stand mid-court backward and throw it in. He just couldn't miss. And there was one of those shots, you know the kind of clips that they run 1,000 times? They ran this clip over and over. Michael was made a basket. He was running up the court. He looked over at the Knicks bench and said, well, how eloquent, eh? He said, man, don't ask me. And he referred to that as being in a zone. And my God, how many times have I been there? It was a spiritual life's not a theory. We have to live it. But neither is it a theory that it works. Because what I found is that I get in a zone sometime. I was walking through O'Hare Airport in Chicago one day. And in airports, everybody's mad. I mean, they're mad at nobody. They're just mad about being there. And I realized I was going down the concourse grinning. And I'm kind of embarrassed when I discovered that, and I put on my airport face and kept walking. But I thought about it. This was February. I'm on the way to Fargo, North Dakota, and we're fogged in Chicago, and I'm grinning. To be in a zone, there are three things required for this guy. And that's all. One is to be exactly who I'm supposed to be, with no sham and pretense and ego and performing. To be exactly who I'm supposed to be. And to be exactly where I'm supposed to be. That day I was supposed to be in O'Hare because I was on the way to tote the message in Fargo in a snowstorm. Exactly where I was supposed to be. And doing exactly what I'm supposed to be doing that day. Well, when I get like that, I'm not only in a zone, I'm darn near bulletproof. Man, I'm about as strong as they come when I get like that. And that's mine for the taking. All I have to do is plug in and give a broken and wasted life to this simple program. And my God, what happens? What happens? I'm not going to tell you about being rich and famous. I'm not telling you about going from ex-con to warden. Yeah, we'll talk about that another day. Thanks.